Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
Welcome to the show today. On this episode, we're hearing from the policymakers for federal technology and acquisition. Tony Scott is the Federal Chief Information Officer. He spoke recently at the CIO Council's first IT symposium. Then we hear from Ann Rung, who's the administrator in the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. Tony Scott starts off with some observations now that he's been on the job for about 90 days and offers insights into his plans over the next 18 months.
I think, as you've all experienced, we're in a time of profound change in the IT industry. And it doesn't matter whether you're in government or you're in the private sector. It doesn't matter whether you're working in a large organization or a small organization. We're all affected by some of these profound changes that are going on. And you hear words like the pace of change is accelerating and so on, but I actually do think it's true. If you study weather patterns, for example, you understand what happens when certain forces come together to form a storm or a tornado. And you can see visible signs of that acceleration taking place. In the technology industry, we're used to change, and it's something that more or less we've gotten comfortable with. But sometimes, like a frog in water that boils, we don't really understand the impact of it until it's too late. And I'm sure many of you understand the frog in boiling water analogy. And I think in our technology industry, we have to be concerned about that frog in boiling water kind of syndrome. And let me address just a couple of examples to showcase what I mean by that. The first is the digitization of everything. We in the computer industry, and particularly those of you who either have a lot of gray hair as I do, or maybe no hair, you know, we've been through decades of using information technology to automate things that were manual before. But the underlying business processes just haven't changed that much. Many of us spent early parts of our career putting forms that used to be on paper and now presenting them on a computer screen, but the form was still the basic paradigm. And the business model was the form gets circulated to somebody to take action on. And whoever it was that received that form electronically, read through the form, and maybe in some cases the data even went into a database or the form itself was stored. But the business model, the transaction, the workflow, everything around that was essentially the same business process as if it were all done on paper, just a little bit faster. And that application of information technology to business process has been going on for decades. It's the simple paradigm that everybody can relate to. But there's a new world now, and it's called digitization, where we reimagine everything from the start. And it starts with the customer. What does the customer want? What are they trying to do? And we apply all kinds of new technology to try to figure that out. New design techniques, new business models, new workflow, new concepts about how the very thing itself should be done. And we see all kinds of examples of that in the commercial world. And my point on this digitization is relentless, and it won't stop, and it's accelerating, and it's changing everything, including government. You'll see an article this week in Fast Company about our digital services team and some of the work they're doing. And it's one small example of the way that business process is being reimagined everywhere. And you know this to be true from your own experiences. When you buy things on the web, or you make a reservation for a restaurant, or you take a ride any one of the number of commercial services that are now available as an alternative to taxi services, or you rent a room, or any number of other things. To give you an idea of how fast this is happening, I'll just share a couple of tidbits from one of my past lives. I was chief technology officer at General Motors for the information systems group there. And I started in late 99 and left a little after mid-2005, so about 5.5 years. And one of the things I got curious about was how much software was actually in an automobile. So I went back and talked to some of our engineering people, and we looked in some of the archives. And in 1970, which was kind of a seminal year for me, there was about 1,000 lines of software, or the equivalent, in the average automobile. So, not much, you'd say. What can you do with 1,000 lines of code? Well, actually a lot today, but in those days it was pretty simple. In 1990, 20 years later, there was about 100,000 lines of code. So you'd say, well, that's a pretty nice increase in 20 years. In 2010, the 20 years later, there was about 100 million lines of code in the average automobile. Now, that's pretty significant. And it's responsible for everything from better braking systems to better ride control to even things like, you know, better gas mileage. Most everything that you can think about in terms of advances in the automotive industry have mostly happened because of advances in the use of software in the automobile. Now, if you take that same paradigm and apply it to the rest of our everyday experiences, all of the things that we use, all the tools, all the vehicles, all the business processes, all of the various ways that we interact with the things around us, you can see the kind of acceleration that has already happened in the automotive industry and will continue to happen. And I think it's pretty exciting. Now, let me talk about this in the context of business software and the kinds of systems that you and I work on every day. One of the big challenges of our time is cybersecurity. This is making headlines, you know, this week and last week, and probably will continue to make headlines for a long time to come, because cybersecurity is one of the issues of our time. But here's one of the problems. Most of the systems and most of the technology that you and I use every day was designed and architected in the 1970s or the 1990s. Even much of it that has come recently still follows the same architectural paradigm. And to go back to an automotive analogy, it's kind of like trying to put airbags on a 65 Mustang. It just wasn't designed for security. It wasn't designed for safety. We had different issues, different things we were trying to do as we created those software models and software paradigms. And I think the new generation of digital technology has to embrace safety and security by design. It has to be built in as a core part of the fabric of the operating systems and the applications and the interfaces and the networks and all of the user devices that will access technology with and through. And that's a different architectural paradigm, but it is exactly in the spirit of this digitization trend that I'm talking about. So I actually think this is the best time to be in this industry, in the technology industry. We're going to see more change in the next 3 or 4 or 5 years as the technology industry responds to today's challenges and figures out new architectural models and paradigms for the future. And so if you're a student of change, get ready for what I think is going to be a very exciting ride. It leverages technology, it leverages cloud, It leverages good design principles, and it leverages the lessons learned from the last 30 to 40 years of this information age that we're now in. So I'm pretty excited about it. And despite all of, you know, this week's worries and last week's worries and what I'm sure will be next week's worries, I do think there's bright hope in ways that some of these issues can be solved. I'd like to talk about a second challenge as well, and that's a people and cultural challenge. We're at a point right now where many of you, like me, are probably not going to be in the federal workforce a few years from now. We've spent a career in this field, but you know, we're getting of a certain age, and there's vast numbers of us leaving industry and leaving the workforce. I keep getting, you know, Facebook things from my friends who are fishing and playing golf and, you know, doing all these other kind of fun things, and they keep inviting me to go join them, and I keep telling them, not quite yet, not quite done yet, got a little more work to do. But many of us are headed there. But there's a challenge that I think we all have collectively, and that is to make sure that the next generation leaders and the next generation workforce are ready and experienced and trained and have the skill sets and the managerial skills to lead in what I think is going to be this new and very exciting time. And so one of the things that I'm focused on and dedicated to during my time here is to make sure that that next generation leaders get exciting work assignments and get challenged in the right way and can develop the right skills to be the next leaders of this exciting profession that we're all a part of. Somebody I worked for once said, the job of all leaders is to develop the next generation of leaders, and it's something that I've come to appreciate more and more and more as I journey through my own career and now through this assignment. And among other things, I'd welcome ideas from all of you in terms of how we could better do that in the federal government. I think it's one of the most important things that we can do. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about this morning was just our ongoing efforts to be more effective and more efficient in everything that we do. I think there's a myth that, you know, federal employees in IT are, you know, people that are just pouring buckets of money down holes in the ground and don't really care where that money goes and all those kinds of things. And it's not been my experience. That may exist in some places. But what I do see is a culture and a set of, I'll call it soft rules, that make it very hard for all of us to do our work every day. And some of them aren't actually law. Some of them are just norms that have developed in organizations or responses to roadblocks or issues of the past. And so one of the exciting things that I'm dedicated to as a part of my tenure here is to help figure out how we can make IT in the federal government faster and more effective and more responsive to our time, and blow up some of the crazy stuff that all of us run into every single day. It shouldn't take a team of lawyers for one agency to interact with another agency when it's time for that activity to happen. You should just be able to do it, as one example. With my partner Ann, we're working on ways that we can do better contracting in the federal government and make all of the things that we procure and buy, whether it's goods or services, make that easier and more efficient. And Ann will be up here in a little bit. And so there's a ton of things that I think we can do to help our profession and help our organization with its missions and help our country. Many of you know that we just issued our FITARA guidance last week, and so I wanted to spend just a couple of minutes on that, because I know many of you may have questions about that. I'm a big fan of FITARA. And I didn't know that much about it when I was talking with the folks in the West Wing about coming here. But as I learned more about it, the more I got excited about what it can really do for IT and the federal government. The first thing that it does is it codifies best practice that we can all look around and see is best practice in any other institution anywhere around the world. And that's strong engagement of the IT team with the leadership of that organization, whether it's a business or a federal government entity. Today, technology and business process and government process are so intertwined that it's crazy to think about even separating them. And so FITARA gives us good guidance in how governance and interaction among senior leaders in particular in an agency should exist. And OMB and our role in the eGov unit is to look at agency plans and make sure that there's a good governance model in place and that those right conversations are taking place. And if you think about nothing else about FITARA, think about good governance and good conversation and pithy conversations that enable the leadership of whatever organization is involved to make the best possible decisions going forward. That, to me, is FITARA in its essence. Now, there's a number of other things in there as well. This is probably the key to success from my perspective. I'm excited about it. We issued our guidance last week. Agencies have a pretty short period of time to file with us their plans, although it should come as no surprise. We've been signaling this for a long time. And I'm really excited to see what comes back. I think it's going to be a big, big change. Now, one of the things I've been warned about is there were past acts. There was Clinger-Cohen. There were a number of other attempts at reform in the past. And I do think this time is different. And it's different for two reasons. One, I think times have changed. And I think more and more people get that information technology is an integral part of everything we do, and that success or failure depends on how well we do our jobs, and by implication, how well good governance takes shape in any organization. The second thing that's different is the authors of Clinger-Cohen left Congress shortly after it was passed. The authors of this act aren't going anywhere anytime soon, they tell me. And they intend to be mindful watchers of how well we implement and what we do. And I welcome that. I think it's exactly what's needed. Because what I've learned, if nothing else over the years, is if all parts of the machine aren't working, in our case that's Congress and the executive branch, they're not working, it's hard to get anything done. And in this case, we've got great support and we've got great momentum going into this. So I welcome your participation and your enthusiastic support.
We have to take a break. You just heard from federal CIO Tony Scott. He spoke recently at the CIO Council's first IT symposium. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. In this part of the show, we hear from Ann Rung, the administrator in the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. Rung also spoke at the CIO Council's first IT symposium. She detailed how OFPP is working closely with Tony Scott on federal IT acquisition reform efforts.
Last December, I laid out a blueprint for the next few years, and it's focused around three areas. One is category management, one is innovation, and the third is building stronger vendor relationships. And we're starting in each of these areas in IT acquisitions, mainly because it's a huge area of spend. It's very challenging, and it recently made GAO's high-risk list. So just briefly on category management, some of you may have heard me talking about this before, but essentially it's about breaking down all the agency silos and starting to act as the world's largest buyer. So category management builds on something that's been done in a lot of the retail industries where you have teams of experts around categories like in the retail industry, housewares and clothing. And also it's been adopted in the UK, which is a little bit smaller than us. They're about 40 billion pounds a year. We're $440 billion a year. But the concept is that we're breaking all the common spend into categories, and we're going to manage each one like its own mini business with its own set of strategies and with a team of experts running each category. And the buying will still happen in the agencies, but we really want somebody to dig into the data around a certain category. We know the federal procurement data system doesn't give us a lot of visibility into what we buy and how we buy and where we're buying it and the pricing that we're paying. And we also want that team to really think about government-wide strategies that we could launch. So I'm talking to all of you about this because we're doing our deepest dive into the IT category. So we took about $270 billion that we roughly estimated was common spend, and we divided them into 10 major categories. Professional services, transportation are just a couple examples, but IT is one category. And there's lots of subcategories, of course, under that. So in IT, we've got software and hardware, for example. So I've been working together with Tony and his team, and of course the IT and the acquisition workforce, on helping to sort of manage this IT category. And let me give you some specifics of what we're doing. So in the software space, GAO has consistently written about how none of our agencies know how many software licenses we have. So we have lousy inventories. We're not managing them in the best way. We have very little visibility into the prices we're paying, et cetera. So that's where we're starting to tackle the IT spaces and software. So we spend about $5.5 billion on software. And by the way, I'm fairly certain that number is not exactly right. So when we start digging into this, we'll probably find out it's a much different number. And the majority of the spend flows through two major government-wide contracts, the GSA Schedules and NASA SUP. We have about 41,000 transactions in the software space every year, and we average spending of about $126,000 for each one of those transactions. So that would suggest a really inefficient and fragmented system. And further exacerbating the problem, as I mentioned, is that agencies buy and manage their licenses in a very decentralized manner. And to get accurate inventories, it's very challenging. So, and we definitely don't share best practices and pricing information. So earlier this year, Tony Scott and I chartered an enterprise software category team, and it's co-led by my deputy director, Leslie Field, and Mary Davey, who is one of the government's most senior and experienced IT acquisition professionals at GSA. And the third individual is the deputy CIO at DOD, Dave DeVries. And what I love about this is, one, we've got great representation from the agencies, and two, it's the IT and acquisition community working together. So this team is tasked with developing a strategic plan to increase the number of enterprise-wide software agreements we have. This was actually called for in FITARA, and it's just good business practice anyway. They're also going to recommend some policy changes to OMB to improve the acquisition and management of software and monitoring agency progress. We're going to use the existing portfolio stat process to hold agencies accountable for moving forward to these shared solutions. So you can expect to see guidance later this summer from OMB in the software area. FITARA also called for us to establish a new regulation that says contracting officers, if they don't use an existing government-wide strategically sourced solution, they've got to put a business case or a justification in their contract file as to why they're not using that government-wide solution. And we think this will greatly help us in reducing some of the duplication across government. There's also a cross-agency team of acquisition and IT professionals who've been looking at workstations. So they've made a number of recommendations to us, including moving towards a common, more limited set of requirements for workstations. And so you will also see OMB guidance coming out later this summer in that area as well. We're also taking a number of steps to institutionalize category management through an online portal. So one of the things we heard over and over again from the contracting workforce is that they actually don't know what existing contracts we have, which would explain in part why we have so much duplication. So everyone's going out to the open market when we already have 6 or 7 government-wide solutions in place. So GSA has established something called the Acquisition Gateway, where we're starting to populate each one of these categories with contract information. So a summary of the requirements, a summary of which agencies can use these contracts, the fee charged by the agencies, and eventually we want to get the prices paid in there as well. So for our acquisition workforce, we're starting to populate that with IT contract information. So agencies have been giving us their bureau-wide and agency-wide and government-wide IT contract information. Some of it's available now on the website, and some of it will soon be available in the next month or so. So we'll make sure you all have that link to access that contract information. And we've also got communities up, kind of communities of practice going, where people can share information, ask questions, et cetera. And now a piece that we're doing in the innovation space. So Tony and I are working together on a workforce training piece. And essentially what we're trying to do here is move the acquisition workforce from having to be jacks of all trades or generalists into specialized teams. And we're starting in the IT space. So a lot of agencies have IT cadres, about half. And FITARA calls for all the agencies to have IT cadres. But we really want to start creating really specialized training for our acquisition workforce. And many of you, I know, have heard of the digital services team, which are technologists that they recruited from Silicon Valley to work on some IT projects. We want to create the acquisition equivalent of that team. So we've got a couple people in the digital services team working with our folks in the Office of Federal Procurement Policy to develop sort of the first certified digital IT acquisition team. We're working with industry to put together the training. And what makes us a little different from the digital team is we're going to recruit career contracting officers from the agencies and put them through this training for about 6 months. And early next year, we want to send them back to the agencies and really have them providing that kind of hands-on support and guidance on IT acquisitions, at least in the digital space. And sort of a real-life example of what you can do here is that we often hear, you know, our requirements are too government-specific, overly prescriptive, too long. And these teams really know how to write very succinct statement of objectives. They know how to think about soliciting concept papers from industry instead of really lengthy proposals. They know how to think about maybe issuing, you know, $10,000 for the 5 finalists to develop prototypes. This is what Mark Nager is doing in the HHS Buyers Clubs. And that leads me to another initiative we're working on with Tony Scott, is really helping agencies develop these buyers clubs or innovation labs across government. And to me, you know, I often hear that there's no upside to taking risk from our acquisition workforce, and I'm sure that as IT professionals, you feel the same way. And so we want to create these innovation labs where people feel like they can be innovative and try new things, all allowed in the federal acquisition regulations, but maybe not widely understood or used. And I think what was key for Mark's Buyers Club in HHS was that he reported directly to the CTO and felt like he had their support and the, you know, the backing of the leadership of his agency to try new things. So we're going to be issuing a memo later this summer to the agencies, really encouraging them to start these buyers clubs. And we don't want to be overly prescriptive. We want to let agencies have the flexibility to develop it as they see fit, but we'll just have some general principles that we think they should follow. And in many ways, I think this also helps further FITARA's goals of developing more specialized teams around government. So we've also got some tools that we've created for the workforce. And you may have heard of the Digital Services Playbook, which is, it identifies a series of plays drawn from private sector best practices to help agencies successfully implement digital services. And another tool is the TechFAR, which, you know, it's interesting, like other countries are fascinated with this and some of the state governments. And it was developed in partnership with my office and Tony's office and the Office of Science and Technology. And it just highlights flexibilities in the federal acquisition regulations that the workforce can use to implement plays in the playbook. And it's set up as a Q&A structure to really kind of answer some of your basic questions. And to help get the word out, I've developed a series of podcasts where I go around and interview some of our contracting officers on how they've been using the tech FAR and the playbook to really kind of drive innovation. So I think we've done our fourth or fifth podcast, and we're going to be doing that throughout the summer. So if any of you have somebody that you want me to interview, just let me or my office know. And finally, we're developing a tech FAR hub within GSA's acquisition gateway. So that's where you can find, you know, the best ways to implement digital services and agile approaches. And it's going to have all the buyer's club information and tech FAR and playbook information there as well. So finally, in strengthening vendor relationships, but I did issue guidance recently to your agencies on directing them to seek feedback from vendors and internal stakeholders on high-dollar IT acquisitions. And it's the first time we've asked people to give us feedback on specific acquisitions, and the first time we've asked industry for their feedback on specific acquisitions. So it's a standard set of questions. Agencies are applying it this year to two acquisitions that have already occurred, but moving forward, we've asked them to apply it to 50 IT acquisitions, or 5% of their acquisitions. What makes it a 360 is that for that same acquisition, we want the program management office to rate the contracting office and the contracting office to rate the program management office. So we're getting really a full 360 feedback on that acquisition. And, you know, I think over time, as the data starts coming in, we think that it can really help identify some areas where we're strong and some areas where we may need to do better. So it's a standard set of questions. And it's also designed to help you, the agencies, get better insight into, you know, some of your good areas and some of your more challenging areas. But there are questions like, did you have enough time to respond to the solicitation? Did it allow you to offer an innovative solution? Did you have a quality debriefing? And we realize there's all sorts of reasons why somebody may rate something low or high. But we think over time you could sort of start to identify kind of trends and significant areas that require another look. And we do ask both the winning and the losing proposers to provide feedback. So
we have to take a break. You just heard from Ann Rung, the administrator in the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. She spoke recently at the CIO Council's first IT symposium. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. In this part of the show, we shift gears to my recent interview with Emile Monet, the Senior Advisor for Resilience and Cybersecurity in the General Services Administration's Office of Government-Wide Policy. I caught up with him recently after he led an industry day to develop a cybersecurity risk management framework for acquisitions.
The core of those recommendations is really number four, to develop a government-wide cybersecurity risk management strategy for federal acquisitions. And why that's the core is because it drives most of the other ones. You know, you think about having baseline cybersecurity requirements as a condition for contract award for appropriate acquisitions. Well, we don't really know what appropriate acquisitions are until we fully understand the risk posture of those acquisitions. And so last week's public meeting was an important step, really, in toward implementing this recommendation number four. When we started to do some work towards implementation of this risk management strategy for acquisitions, we pretty quickly came upon the fact that we've got a gap in how the federal acquisition system applies the NIST risk management framework to its activities. And to be more specific there, risk assessment is an important step in the application of the risk management framework. When we looked at how the risk management framework is used in the federal acquisition system, we found that acquisition decision makers often lack robust information about the decisions they're making. And so they're not able to make as good of an assessment about the risk as they might if they had more information. And so that's one of the goals that we are after right now. At the meeting, we had about 120 attendees, about two-thirds of which were from the private sector. We had a few members of the press, and five members of the public made presentations to the group as part of the meeting. The meeting was really focused on being transparent and clearly communicating the background of the RFI, providing an overview of the RFI responses, and soliciting more public feedback about the problem, which is, you know, this information gap and the potential solutions. as you might imagine, there's a range of opinion and thought about how the government should approach cyber risk management in acquisitions. And one of the things that came out of the meeting from my perspective was, you know, the likelihood of obtaining an overwhelming consensus on how the government does this is you know, probably pretty slim. But we are committed to the process of being, you know, transparent and inclusive and getting as close to that consensus as possible. What did come out of the meeting that is very positive is that the attendees really strongly endorsed a common approach across the government. And in large part, that's because it will reduce the costs of serving the federal customer by providing consistency and clarity in the acquisition process.
All right. So there's a lot there. Let me back up for a second and start with the question around the risk assessments, the implementation of the NIST risk management framework. Is it part of the reason why this is a gap and a challenge is because no one's ever told them or showed them how to do it? Or is there something more to it? Is it not written for the acquisition world, so therefore the acquisition people don't necessarily understand how to implement it?
It's probably some of all of the above. I think if you dig into NIST special publications and start reading those things, they are relatively arcane. It's a complex subject matter when you talk about information security and managing that risk. And to your second point there, there is sometimes a gap in the acquisition workforce's application of the appropriate risk management guidance from NIST. And so we had a cyber incident in 2013 that involved government purchasing a service from a company, and the acquisition officials involved in the buying activity didn't include some of the requirements to have NIST controls in place because they didn't consider what they were buying to be IT. They thought they were buying a service, and they were, but it involved the transmission of data back and forth between the government and the contractor, and that data ended up getting out of that system, and that was a bad thing.
So is the first piece here training? I mean, getting acquisition workforce to understand where cyber fits, where the NIST framework fits?
That is certainly part of it. But I think there's also some translation, if you will, that can be done as part of that training, maybe as development of those training materials that take the IT security language out of the NIST publications and translates that into something that is more business-oriented that an acquisition official might understand easier.
The other thing you mentioned about this idea was there was not consensus that we could get to a consensus. Is that just because this is such a big problem? I mean, what kind of reaction did you get from those in the audience back in early June from, as you said, 120 attendees, two-thirds were private sector?
Some offered the opinion that the government has a lot of information already about contractor performance, about compliance systems, about, you know, certainly for public companies, about public disclosures and things of that nature. And the government ought to first look at getting its arms around and using that information in a more meaningful way in the acquisition process, instead of looking to gather new information about contractors. And my response to that is that, one, it's true, and part of what we're looking at here is a way to pull in those existing government databases where you know, you might have things in the SEC disclosures that are made by a public company that might inform risk in an acquisition, and we should be using those things. We might have access to judicial proceedings or other things that are relevant to a company risk that we could also use in the procurement process. But what we're also looking at, in addition to those things, is all of the information that's available about contractors in big data. And we really think part of what we need to get to is taking a look at public records, publicly available information, and some of the information that is available from commercial subscription services, for example. And we need to aggregate that data and have a risk picture about the companies that we do business with that is more robust than the risk picture that a contracting officer gets today or that an acquisition official gets today.
You mentioned the RFI. You received 29 responses. I think you guys put the RFI out in December. Talk about some of the trends you saw And what comes next now that this RFI is out and you have responses?
We got 29 responses to the RFI, and then the RFI was, you know, we gave it a long title because we're in the government and that's what we do well. We called it Using Business Due Diligence Information in Acquisitions of Information Technology and Information. You can boil it down to getting a better risk picture when you're doing IT acquisition. That RFI was all about improving government decision making. You know, we all make better decisions when we have the right information at our fingertips. And so GSA, in collaboration with a group of agency partners, are being deliberate about engaging with the public to ask what information the government should have at its fingertips when it makes decisions about spending money on contracts. As you mentioned, we got 29 responses, and they came from multiple perspectives. We got responses from independent audit firms, from consulting firms, from some niche providers that do business due diligence for merger and acquisition activity. We got responses from big data aggregators, from some IT product vendors, from universities, and from some industry consortia. Respondents largely agreed that the risk indicators that we listed in the RFI, and some of those came out of the FAR and others were just things that we culled from sort of experience, that those risk indicators are appropriate to assess business risk broadly, but some questioned the relevance of particular types of risk information to cybersecurity risk specifically. And so one of the things that came up in the meeting was, well, you're asking about foreign ownership of Acme Corp. as part of this risk picture. What does that have to do with cybersecurity? And, you know, the answer might be that it doesn't have anything to do with cybersecurity directly, but we do know that there are certain geographies in the world that are more conducive to bad actors subverting the supply chain and getting things into a line of software code or a chip that ends up in, you know, a national security system or a major weapon system or even any other lower moderate impact federal system. And those are things that we need to pay attention to.
That's all the time we have for the show. Today, we heard from federal CIO Tony Scott, OFPP Administrator Anne Rung, and Emil Monet, the Senior Advisor for Resilience and Cybersecurity in the General Services Administration's Office of Government-Wide Policy. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you've been listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.